edition of the Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are going back to Alfred Hitchcock and looking at his 1946 hit film, Notorious. Returning on the show today to talk about Notorious is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So when I think about this movie, I feel that it's a great representation not only of Alfred Hitchcock, it has so many good examples of what a Hitchcock film is in this movie, but it also is a good representation of like the golden age of Hollywood. You know, it's like on the side of Hollywood, it's got, you know, two huge stars from that era, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman. It's got the big elaborate sets. It's got the, you know, the score, the music. I mean, it feels very much like a classical Hollywood movie. And it's just in a lot of the great stuff for a Hitchcock film. You've kind of got the way he sort of dances around the Hays Code, which we'll talk a little bit later, but a lot of iconic shots. I mean, there's a great example of a MacGuffin. So it's got all those great examples of what a Hollywood movie, old school Hollywood movie, and what a Hitchcock movie is.
And in the golden age of the 40s, you know, when I think most of the best movies were made.
Definitely. And, you know, but I think what's really interesting about this movie is the way it just sort of danced around the Hays Code throughout the movie. And one way is every character in the movie has to, you know, sort of mentions, you know, makes sort of negative connotations towards Alicia's character. It's like, well, we know what kind of girl she is. You know, they say that a lot. They're not specifically saying that, but everybody thinks she's kind of a skank or kind of slutty or whatever.
Actually, the original script, she was actually supposed to be a prostitute.
Interesting. And so you got that. And probably one of the most famous scenes in the movie, which also flirted around the Hays Code, was the kissing scene. Now, apparently, because the Hays Code always had these really silly rules, like, you know, which Hitchcock sort of used later with Psycho with the toilet. But, you know, you can only, when characters were kissing, they can only maintain contact for, I believe, 3 seconds. Mm-hmm. So Hitchcock decided to, I'm going to have this really long scene where they keep kissing each other, but they kiss no longer than 3 seconds, but they keep doing it over and over again.
Right. And then they're nuzzling and then they're talking and then they're kissing some more. And then, it goes on and on and on and on.
And just once again, he's just sort of toying with it, but he's still like, hey, I'm just following the rules. I'm within the rules. You know?
And it looks good and it looks believable, but apparently it was very hard to do for the actors because they felt like it was extremely artificial. And of course, doing it, they're thinking, why are we doing it like this? Because this is weird. They couldn't see how it was supposed to look. And, you know, Ingrid Bergman was famous for asking a lot of questions of Alfred Hitchcock. What did he want? And why do this? And why not do that? And he said, it's just a movie.
You know, actually, you bring that up about her, you know, kind of talking a lot with Hitchcock. There's one interesting story. She wanted to do it. She was talking about a scene with him, and she said for some way she wanted to change the way it was set up and everything. And I guess when she was like saying, well, we should do this and we should do this, and like everybody else around the set was just stopping and staring at her because Hitchcock is the guy that says, I have it the way I want, and damned anybody else wants to say it. And so he just kind of looked at her a little bit. He goes, you're right, Ingrid. Let's change it. And that's it. And it's just like, that's just like such a rare occurrence, but he actually did it.
That must have been the only time that happened, you know, because he was famous for storyboarding everything to the nth degree.
Yeah.
And by the time he showed up on the set, he was kind of bored with the thing because he'd already seen it in his mind and it was already done. And that's why when Selznick would show up, he'd want extra scenes and why don't we do it a couple of ways? And he had it, you know, no, I've already mapped it out. We're doing it like this and we're doing it that way once.
Yeah, and so we actually talked about Selznick. I know this film, so maybe how that story about with Bergman, maybe he was trying to like somehow stick it to Selznick.
I think everybody wanted to stick it to Selznick because I know that Bergman didn't like working with Selznick. He kept her out of work when she wanted to work. He wanted to prolong her contract against her will. He wouldn't let her appear on the radio. And when he sold her services to other students, he never gave her an increase in salary. So nobody liked working with Selznick.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine that was probably like a lot with the big studio heads at that time with the studio system where it's basically like, I control you. Mm-hmm. You know, you have no say in what you want to do.
Although to be fair, you know, Alfred Hitchcock kind of thought that actors were cattle. And the perfect actor was Mickey Mouse because you didn't have to pay him and you could always erase him.
Yeah, it's funny. And one thing that's so interesting about this movie is it's a came right after World War II. And it's very kind of talks about that post-World War II fear a lot of Americans had, where there are still Nazis out there and they're on this continent, because a lot of Nazis after World War II fled to places like Argentina for a long time. So you definitely feel it's playing on that fear of like they're still out there and they're still going to be making plans even though they've been defeated.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect time to have brought that movie out, because that topic would have been very interesting and a little, you know, salacious, you know, something you don't want to think about, but would make a good movie.
Yeah, and you can tell the story is definitely a little very, at the time, nowadays it's nothing, but at the time it was very salacious because, you know, once again, they're making references to her character, but they're basically wanting her to prostitute herself to Claude Rains' character, you know, so they can get secrets about it. They're basically saying, you make him happy, you do what you got to do, but you got to get those secrets.
The other thing about that time period is that Alfred Hitchcock and Ben Hecht consulted Nobel Prize winner Dr. Robert Millikan on how to make an atomic bomb. He refused to answer, but confirmed that the principal ingredient, uranium, could fit in a wine bottle.
Oh, okay.
So that's why that's how they got that in there.
And wine bottle probably leads in perfectly. One of my next notes is it's probably one of the best examples of what a MacGuffin is. And MacGuffin is, overall, the whole point of the story isn't really what the object is, but it's an object that gets the plot going. And it's not going to be the most important thing, but it just gets the plot going. And yeah, so it'd be like the money in Psycho or this. You know, once again, the whole point of the film isn't the wine bottling uranium, but it's, you know, it helps propel the plot going forward.
Yes, which is, and you forget about it later. Then you think, wait a minute. And you don't have to go back to it and pick up the thread. It's a little bit of a red herring.
Oh, I want to talk about some of the other famous stuff in this movie. The way it's a Hitchcock movie is sort of just the way he uses the cinematography, which I'll give the name, it's Ted Tetzlaff. There's so many great uses of cinematography in this scene. Like, one is the long take at the party at the beginning, you know, when she's, you know, she's the hostess, she's giving, everybody's just getting hammered, and you know, and we see this character silhouetted in the background. She keeps talking to him. You know, he's a party crasher. We don't know who he is, and we realize it's Cary Grant. And it's just a great introduction to that character, sort of. He is sort of shadowy and mysterious, and you really, even from the most movie, you don't really know what he's going to do. And you got that scene, and then you have the use of the Dutch angle when Ingrid Bergman wakes up, and you can tell she's very hungover, and she's looking at, you know, Cary Grant, and it's sort of distorted because, you know, her head, she's got a headache. So that's another classic Hitchcock. And then probably the other most famous shot in the movie is the tracking shot at the beginning of the party. Is, you know, we see it all wide, you know, all starts out wide, everybody's at the party, we see Ingrid Bergman in her black dress, gets closer, and she sees right behind her hand, she's, you know, fiddling with that key.
Yeah, it starts off with a crane shot. So you're looking at down at the party from this, like, the viewpoint of the chandelier, and then you sort of sink down into the party, and you're noticing all the things around you. And the great thing about the way that is shot is how it draws your eye down to her hands held behind her back and what she has in her hands, which is that Unica key. Yeah, great shot. Then that other shot that you mentioned where she's they've got that giant coffee cup. The way he did that shot was to use a really big cup and then place it in a way that made it work out but could keep them both in perfect focus.
And that's when she's realizing she's getting poisoned.
The coffee cup, I think that's in the scene where she's feeling sick.
Oh, when she starts to feel sick.
Yeah.
Okay.
And as far as the Unica key, Cary Grant kept it. And then a few years later, he gave the key to Ingrid Bergman, saying it had given him luck and he hoped it would do the same for her. And then decades later, at a tribute to Alfred Hitchcock, Bergman went off script and presented the key to him.
Oh, really?
So, you know, the fact that that key was so... It has such a great place in the movie. Great token.
And just another great scene in that movie with the key is when she takes the key, and then, you know, Claude Rains is in the background getting dressed or something for the party. So you're kind of, it's very tense because you're wondering, is he going to come in and discover what she's doing? And it keeps building and building. And then it's when he's kissing her hand and she's got her hands clenched because one of them has the key. He kisses the one hand that's empty and he's about to do the next one. And then she goes and she just hugs him. And it's a great, great scene.
And then drops it and then kicks it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very clever. And without giving herself away.
Definitely. And then just another another great old school Hollywood aspect is all the big stars are in this movie. You got Ingrid Bergman, you got Cary Grant, and you got Claude Rains. I mean, two people from Casablanca, and then Cary Grant. I mean, just everybody big in this movie.
Yeah, and by the way, Claude Rains had to stand on a box with Ingrid Bergman because he was so short. Mm-hmm. He was like 7 inches shorter than Cary Grant. But they did a lot of tricky things to make him look taller, which they actually do with a lot of actors.
Yeah, I know they kind of did the same thing with Kirk Douglas in a lot of movies because he's pretty short.
And Tom Cruise.
Oh, yeah, Tom Cruise. And, you know, what's interesting, we talk about Claude Rains. A bit of Norman Bates. I got a little bit of Norman Bates in him as far as his relationship with his mother. Now, I know this movie came just like – was the first movie Hitchcock made after his mom died. And I know a lot of the mother characters in his movies, like the mom in Psycho or the mom in this movie, kind of are somewhat a representation of his mother.
And he had a really problematic relationship with his mother. This is one of the great mother roles. Mm-hmm. And that actress, I think this is the only thing that she did.
Really? Was she more of a stage person?
I think so. Okay. But yeah, Leopoldine Constantine. In real life, she's only 4 years older than Claude Rains. No, this is her only role in an American film, so I think she did other things. But what a great character. I mean, she's just so imposing.
Yeah, and I love that scene when he's finally coming to her because he finds out that Alicia's the spy. And, you know, she just has this look on her face. It's like, I knew it. You can just see it on her face.
I think that Ingrid Bergman was a good choice for this role too, because she looked a little bit exotic, but still had that all American girl look. They considered other actresses, of course. Selznick wanted Vivian Leigh.
Oh, okay. Oh, because of Gone with the Wind.
I think also he was involved with her too, and Vivian Leigh had a reputation for being sort of the wild party girl, so she would have done a good job with it too. I don't think she would have gotten the sweetness that we get with Ingrid Bergman. You feel sorry for her.
Oh, you definitely feel sorry for her because everybody, you know,
uses her,
and they're basically making her a prostitute for this. And it's interesting. It's sort of like right after World War II, so you think patriotism would be high. Here's this movie where the government is making a woman prostitute herself to get secrets from the Nazis, you know?
And she's sort of considered to be a traitor because her father was.
Yeah, it's interesting, but yeah, and it's interesting. A good talk about her all Americanness of Ingrid Bergman. It's sort of an interesting contrast. You know, she's supposed to be all American, but everybody in the movie sort of makes remarks about her promiscuity.
Yeah, which I don't find there's no evidence of it that you see on the screen. It's just rumors and what people say.
Yeah, and it's just sort of, okay, so what? I mean, that doesn't mean she's a bad person.
Although this is the 40s.
Yeah, that would be, like I said, they're dancing around that Hays Code because they can't just explicitly say she's had a lot of partners, you know, or something like
right,
that.
Right, yeah. And they wouldn't be able to show that either.
Mm-mm. And I think another thing I do want to bring up in this movie, which I think is very iconic, is the classic black dress by Ingrid Bergman. This was created by Edith Head. And if you want to study somebody who's not a director or a film person, but who's not a director, you should study her because she's probably done like every movie that ever existed in the 30s, 40s, or 50s because it's just amazing. And, you know, just once again, a very iconic dress by Ingrid Bergman. And just sort of, once again, that scene with that opening shot, you're definitely looking at her. And it's because of that dress. And just definitely check her out if you want to see somebody who's doing something in costume design.
Oh, yeah. She was nominated, I don't know how many times, and I think she won 8 times. And she... all of the great costumes in Hitchcock movies were done by Edith Head. Mm-hmm. He would even get her involved in what his actresses wore when they weren't in the movie. Mm. So for Tippi Hedren, of course, Edith Head did all of her costumes for the birds and for Marnie. But off screen, he had her design an entire wardrobe for Tippi Hedren.
Oh, wow.
Casual clothes, furs, just everything for her to wear. He basically remade her using Edith Head as, you know, the designer. Yeah. But she did some incredible, incredible outfits.
Yeah, just, and once again, you look at her IMDb page. Mm-hmm. I mean, I almost wonder, like, how did she have time to, like, relax and just, like, have a day to herself? Because she's done every movie ever made, almost.
Now, you've seen The Incredibles?
Yes, I've heard the rumor. I think you told me earlier
that
Edna Mode's based on her.
No capes. No capes. Yeah, she looks like her. And of course, the name is close enough too. You know, Edna, Edith.
And yeah, just definitely check her out. And we have to talk about a bit about Cary Grant, because we talked a little bit about Suspicion in the other episode, how they didn't want to make Cary Grant look like a bad guy. And he's not necessarily a, he's not the bad guy in this movie, but he's very cold. He's very cold. He treats Bergman pretty badly. Like, the one scene that's pretty low blow was, you know, she's like, oh, you know, he's like, he has to tell her something, and she's joking around. It's like, oh, you tell me you have a family or something, and you can't stand them any longer. He's like, well, I bet that's not the first time you've heard that before. And he gets very upset with her when she says, you know, you can add Sebastian to my list of playmates. He's very cold and almost feels like he doesn't really care about her for most of the film until the end.
You know, I absolutely love Cary Grant as an Alfred Hitchcock actor in a way that I think he does better than a Jimmy Stewart. Because Jimmy Stewart, you always think the best of Jimmy Stewart. You know, even in Vertigo, where he's really pretty creepy. But Cary Grant, he's beautiful, but yet with the dark, dark eyes and the dark, dark hair, you just sort of see a darkness that's like lingering just under the surface. I think that makes him the perfect Hitchcock actor. Mm-hmm. Now, they actually thought about Joseph Cotten for this role, and I don't think he would have brought that sort of sex appeal.
No, because Cotten, to me, has always had like a sense of humor a little bit, or he could be funny. I mean, Cary Grant's been in a lot of screwball comedies, but he doesn't have that in a Hitchcock movie, where he maybe a little bit North by Northwest, but...
Yeah, there are some goofy moments in North by Northwest when he gets drunk, for example. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but nothing like Arsenic and Old Lace.
No, he like in this movie, he's very cold, and he can be sinister when he wants to be.
Also, he slugs her.
Oh, yeah, he slugs her, knocks her, yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. I think that was more acceptable in the 40s.
Yeah, it's sort of, there's a lot of scenes like that in that time where, you know, some woman's getting hysterical and they snap out of it, babe, and you know, slap her or something like that. Especially in, like, gangster movies, they do that all the time.
Yep.
Let's see. And when I was, it was interesting, when I was looking at the, some facts about this movie, one thing I noticed was the film's score by Roy Webb, and a lot of people were talking about it. And we've done a few 50s movies, so we talked a lot about Bernard Herrmann. Last one, we talked about Miklos Roza. Roy Webb, he's not a guy that rings a bell for me, but, you know, this is a pretty good score, I would say. And it just seems like it's probably, even though a lot of his work is very well known for his music, Hitchcock's movies, this one seems to have really been buried under, even though it's a classic example of his.
Yeah, I agree. But I don't think Hitchcock worked with him again.
Yeah, this was the only one. Let's see.
We were talking about how hilarious it is, these 40s movies, whenever they're in a car, it's so obvious that they're not in any sort of car. So there's a scene where Alicia's drunkenly speeding along a South Florida road, and it's shot in the studio with the rear projection, and so looks like
it. Yeah, so it looks like it. One of my favorite parodies of that is an airplane. And they're driving the car, and then he hits somebody with a bike, and you don't see the bike, but you just see it in the background. The guy falls down, and then the screen turns to like when they're in an old west, and a bunch of cowboys are shooting at them. It's funny.
This was actually a remake.
Oh, remake of what?
Yeah, of a silent film called Convoy. It's a lost 1927 silent World War I drama, starring Lowell Sherman and Dorothy McHale.
Interesting.
Yeah. I guess this sort of story, though, I think is maybe one of the classics.
Yeah. It's sort of, you know, woman's going under spy. She has to pretend she's in love with somebody to get secrets. She's probably doing this because she's in love with one of the other spy agents. There's this conflict of love. I know when I was reading this, one of the, you know, notable examples they'd said was the second Mission Impossible movie. Or I even said like one of the episodes of a Star Wars TV show actually was influenced by this.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
And so I guess so we could keep on the topic, we could talk about influence of Alfred Hitchcock on other directors. Now, recently, I've been kind of wanting to say this because it's been getting a bit annoying, but I've been watching a lot of Brian De Palma movies lately. And that guy, it's almost just like he wants to tell you that he's a Hitchcock fan almost. And it just gets too obvious. Like, for example, I was watching Carrie, which is the Stephen King novel about the teenage girl that gets psychic powers, and every time her telekinetic powers were would go into gear, you would hear the from Psycho, and it just like stop. And then it got to one of the scenes when her psycho mom, which is actually a good pun, comes after him. she comes after him with a knife, like Norman Bates in Psycho, and it's just stop. And it, you know, and it, like even the movie, have you ever seen Dressed to Kill?
Yes, but it's been a long time.
That movie is basically Psycho. It's just, you know, it's basically, but it's more R-rated, I would say.
Well, Brian De Palma, I think, leans too hard on the gore keys. You know, there's so much more blood. It's so much more obvious. It's not as sophisticated, I don't think, as Hitchcock. Because he doesn't hold back with the gore.
No, he doesn't hold back with anything. Like, even Dressed to Kill, I think it got an NC-17 rating because not only the violence, but there's a lot of sex in that movie. Like, the opening scene is, you feel like, well, what kind of movie am I watching? You get something like that. And Brian De Palma, I think, is a very talented director. I don't want to say he's a hack or anything, but it's just like, okay, it's like with Tarantino. There's a line between paying homage and we're just like beating us over the head with your influence. And there's a line and you've crossed it.
Although I do like to, whenever I show clips from Hitchcock, whether it's a Hitchcock class or another class, I love to show scenes from High Anxiety.
Yeah, I do love that movie. I believe actually Hitchcock loved it. Like he even sent him a glass of wine saying, don't feel any anxiety about this movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but even in Dressed to Kill, like even talked about earlier, the really bad exposition scene in Psycho, there is even a really bad exposition scene in a scene with the psychologist at the end of that movie. And it's just, you know, stuff like that. Like I still kind of enjoy Carrie. I still kind of enjoy Dressed to Kill. But just, you know, there's a point where you just don't be so obvious in what you're doing.
Yeah, and I think people who aren't even, like De Palma, who are clearly fans of Hitchcock and using the stuff to on purpose. I think that lots of people use elements, you know, like going into a window, which always feels very Hitchcock because he was fascinated with that whole voyeuristic shot. And he opened a couple movies like that, Rope and Psycho, open with, you know, going into an open window.
Or just even like a peephole or just any movie that kind of deals with the concept of voyeurism, which I know I'm getting on a De Palma tear, but another movie he did was Body Double. And I'm going to tell you the plot of it and see if you can figure out what movie this is. And it's this guy who sees this woman across the peeping in on her. And then he thinks that he suspects a murder has occurred. What movie do you think that is?
You know, there's Patrice Leconte, the French director who we talked about.
What did he, I forget what was the one we did?
He did a movie with Michel Blanc, I think the actor's name is. And it is about, it's all Hitchcock. And he borrows so many things from so many different movies. It's fun to put them side by side, you know, like the red handbag from Rear Window, because it's about a guy who's spying on the woman across, you know, the quad and ends up in a relationship with her.
Yeah,
and then, but it's Hitchcock all over the place.
Yeah, and even bring up more about Rear Window. I mean, we talked about this one before, but Disturbia kind of is basically a Rear Window for teenagers, you know?
Yeah, but again, goes to the gore, when I think the beauty of Rear Window is more of the suspense and the trying to put the puzzle together.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, sometimes it doesn't have to be gory. And continue more about the talk about his influence Hitchcock's had on one other directors. One thing I noticed in recent news is Matt Reeves, who you probably know is the director of Cloverfield, the last two Planet of the Apes movies. He's going to be directing the new Batman. And one thing he said he really wanted to do was make the new Batman film be like a Hitchcock movie. And I think that would be really interesting because I'm already kind of getting something like a Vertigo, like Batman's obsessing over an old case or something where he couldn't save this one woman or something and she got killed and he's trying to figure it out. I think that could be really interesting. I'd love to see that in like a superhero movie.
Yeah, that would be really cool. Kind of give it that ominous feeling.
And I would love to see that. And any other movies like in nowadays, would you like to see a Hitchcock film or who you feel that is very Hitchcockian, like last 10 years or decade or so?
I'm going to come back to Patrice Leconte. That movie, Monsieur Ear, was just very much an homage to Hitchcock. Who else does Hitchcock? See, I'm not really a fan of horror, but I do like suspense. And nobody does suspense as good as Hitchcock.
No, and sorry, I mean, I don't keep bringing him up, but I just watched a documentary where Brian De Palma is basically being interviewed, and he talks about, like, talks about Hitchcock, and he basically says, I don't know why I'm the only guy that does it. You know, he's basically like such an influential director, but I'm the only one who kind of like really mirrors his style. And he is sort of that way. He's sort of right. You can't, like you said, you can't really point to a lot of people that do Hitchcock like movies.
And when they do, it feels very obvious, like De Palma.
Like De Palma, yeah. Okay, so getting close to the end of my questions, is there anything else I forgot to talk about that you want to bring up?
You know, one anecdote I did want to mention about Claude Rains is that he considered movie acting a mechanical skill. So in rehearsals, he counted. Lifting a cup to his mouth required 5 beats. Drinking took 2. Putting the cup down took 4. When the camera turned, you know, he would mark the time silently, counting to himself, 1, 2, 3. So he was very, very methodical.
Wow.
About his acting. I think that would, I don't know how you can make that seem natural.
Yeah, that'd be very difficult. That'd be very difficult.
But he is, and you know, he's a little bit sympathetic too.
Yeah, because he's got the overbearing mother, and it seems he's really in love with Sebastian.
Yes.
I mean, okay, yeah, he's a Nazi. Okay, hard to feel sympathy for him there.
But he's in love with Ingrid Bergman.
He really loves her.
And she's using him. And then in the end, you know, mm-hmm. we'd like to talk to you.
Very those Nazi guys are very classic Nazi, like something out of an Indiana Jones movie, you know. We'd like to talk to you.
Yes. Yes, very, very ominous. And you do, he's a bad character, but you do feel bad for him. And I think that's Claude Rains coming through. You know, I think he's a really mm-hmm. good actor. In spite of what I just said about how mechanical he was and how he's counting, it works for him. He, mm-hmm. he comes across very well.
Okay. So the last question I'll have is, tell us maybe, do you bring this film to any of your classes in any way?
I show the crane shot. I explain what it is. I say, watch how Hitchcock is making you follow a line all the way to that key. Mm-hmm. And then you close up on that key. And then Cary Grant walks in. You know, they have a little talk. She gives him the key. And then they start talking about the wine, and then I stop right at that point where you have Hitchcock's cameo where he's drinking some champagne and walks off. So I get all that in there. It's like, you know, here's this cool shot. Watch how he's directing your eye, and there's his cameo. It's one of the better ones too.
Yeah, and it's a classic example of a director directing the audience to what to look at.
Yes, because you know there's so many things you could be looking at. Beautiful Ingrid Bergman, beautiful Cary Grant, all of the costumes and everything, the dress you mentioned from Edith Head. But he's very good at making you look at where he wants you to look.
All right. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing Alfred Hitchcock's classic Notorious. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, Alex, will you come in, please? I wish to talk to you.